thank you. I would just like to welcome all our attendees to MHPN's webinar on collaborative care for eating disorder presentation. Our panel tonight are a very talented panel, and I'm sure that you will learn much from them. My name is Michael Murray, and I'll be facilitating tonight's session. I'm a GP in Townsville. I have a special interest in mental health. The first person whom I'd like to introduce you tonight is Jan Orman. Jan Orman is a Sydney GP with a long-standing interest in mental health, especially in mood and eating disorders. And I'd just like to ask you, Jan, how did you come to first have an interest in eating disorders?
I came through my interest in mental health, and I was working at the University Health Service at Sydney University, and because of the demographic of those patients, seeing a lot of people for whom eating disorders were an issue. And I got involved in a shared care diploma that Professor Peter Beaumont was running at Sydney University, and from that point on I was hooked.
Hooked. Good. Sounds like a great introduction. Next person I'd like to introduce is Chris Thornton. Chris is a Sydney-based clinical psychologist. He specialised in the treatment of patients with eating disorders for nearly 20 years, and he's a clinical director of the Red Leaf practice. I should ask you, Chris, how did you become involved in eating disorders?
Oh, look, I wish I had a really, really good story, but my first job actually was just at the inpatient unit of on the eating disorders unit at Northside Clinic. But I guess the more interesting thing is what got me hooked, as I think it's a very good word that Jan kind of uses, which is it's an area where you see so much comorbid psychopathology that you get to use all your skills as a clinical psychologist. And it's such it's an illness which is so fascinating in that these, you know, brilliant and articulate young women starving themselves to death. There's something quite fascinating about that, as well as it's one of the most challenging clinical areas, I think, that are around.
Great, Chris. Thank you for that. That's very insightful. And next, I'd like to introduce Dr. Andrew Court, a Melbourne-based psychiatrist. He's a consultant child and adolescent psychiatrist who originally trained and worked as a paediatrician. He currently works at both the Royal Children's Hospital and in private practice in Melbourne. I suppose I should ask you the same question. Andrew, how did you first become hooked on managing eating disorders?
Well, I, as you say, I was a paediatrician originally, and I first started looking after patients with anorexia nervosa as a paediatrician in my first year of training. In fact, I had a very involved, difficult patient in my first year. I still remember well, and that's a long time ago now. Then I moved over to psychiatry about 15, 17 years ago, and it just happened that my first job was the Royal Melbourne Hospital in the eating disorder unit. I did my long psychotherapy case with a young 17-year-old with anorexia nervosa, and then I've worked in various institutions which just happened to not have an eating disorder service, and I became involved in setting up those services, partly, I think, because of the background in paediatrics, which has really lent itself, I think, to a sort of shared care model with paediatricians and psychiatrists. And traditionally, I think they haven't got on very well together, at least in Victoria, where I come from, we haven't. And so to actually having a bridging role has settled very nicely on my shoulders, given my background in paediatrics.
Thanks, Andrew. That's really, really interesting. We'll next just go into the learning objectives and the case study, which all of our attendees, I'm sure you have all received and all read. And we'll just start off on our PowerPoint presentation shortly after that. As you know, this is an interdisciplinary panel discussion. I've introduced all our panel, and these are the learning objectives. At the end of the session, participants will recognize the key issues in the assessment of eating disorders. You will recognize the key principles of intervention and the roles of different disciplines in treating, managing, and supporting people with eating disorders. And we will all better understand the merits, challenges, and opportunities in providing collaborative care to people with an eating disorder. Now, I'm just going to move hand over to Jan, and she will go through her presentation. Thank you very much, Jan.
first of all, I want to say that I can't think of a disorder that more desperately needs collaborative care than eating disorders. My first comment about Jo in particular is that it's a real shame Jo didn't get to see her GP sooner. We all know that early intervention is paramount in preventing eating disorders from sliding into the revolving door cycle that, in fact, constitute most of the patients that I see. I think with Jo, the missed opportunities for intervention included a chance to have a rational discussion with her about her food allergies at the outset, some gentle counselling about sport and competition, some education about eating disorders and eating behaviours later on, a discussion about responsible vegetarianism, for example, and some issues around physical and self-care and psychological self-care, all of which could have been delivered by her general practitioner earlier than that presentation. It's not unusual for general practitioners to be the first port of call with eating disorders, either directly or indirectly through related symptoms like fatigue or bowel disturbance or over-exercise-related injuries. We know that in the 2 years before diagnosis, eating disorders patients present to their GPs three times more often than age-matched patients. So there are many opportunities for early intervention from general practitioners. It's extremely important that Jo's first visit be handled with great care to ensure ongoing engagement. She's not unusual in her presentation. She's reluctant to admit that she's got a problem at all and unwilling to accept any help. She's not the only kind of patient that presents with eating disorders, though, and increasingly we're seeing younger children, boys, older women, men. And I have to be alert to the fact that not every patient with an eating disorder is a teenage girl. Jo's story contains clues to her vulnerability, and I've highlighted the particular clue to her vulnerability in this slide. Jo also provided some early warning signs for her eating disorder. Her vegetarianism, and I don't want to offend the vegetarians in the audience, but her vegetarianism in the context that it is happening is a very good clue to the development of an eating disorder, along with the food allergies that she is said to be suffering. As her GP, my first task would be to establish rapport with Jo. It's important as a GP, I have an ongoing relationship with every eating disorders patient because I think I should be part of the treating team. It's important to talk about a wide range of things and to follow the advice of one of my patients who said vehemently, "I am not just my eating disorder, please talk to me about other things." My second task is to ensure her physical and psychological safety. I need to do some investigations to ensure that, for example, she isn't suffering from electrolyte disturbances or cardiac complications, and I need to assess her for suicidality in particular, given that suicide is is the highest cause of death amongst eating disorders patients. I need to exclude underlying physical illness, and I need to assess her physical and psychological state in an ongoing way. My second task is to get together a team to look after her. And I think that the general practitioner is an ideal position to coordinate care and communicate with other members of the caring team, including the family. And importantly, I need to monitor her medical and psychological state. So it's important to remember that sometimes, unfortunately, eating disorders patients require hospitalisation. Although we all recognise that ideally we need to keep them out of hospital, they do need hospitalisation in medical emergencies. And these are the sort of things that can happen. Patients who are dynamically compromised, that is their pulse rate falls below 80, they develop a postural drop in their blood pressure, those with significant electrolyte abnormalities, those with ECG changes, those with low temperatures and dehydration and intercurrent illness, remembering that if a low-weight eating disorders patient gets the flu, she's immunocompromised and may not even develop a fever and may get very unwell as a result of that intercurrent illness not being recognised. It's important, therefore, if you are not a medical person, that you have a medical person to call on in situations where there is evidence that this patient may require hospitalisation. And in fact, that medical person, I think, needs to be involved in an ongoing way. Joe needs to be medically managed, and the slide will turn over in a minute. Yes, the basic medical monitoring that a practitioner needs to do for a patient like Joe is to weigh her regularly, take her pulse and blood pressure, both lying and standing, check her electrolytes, particularly if she's purging, take her temperature and do an ECG on a regular basis. There are more longer-term monitoring tasks that need to be done, but these are the really important tasks that need to be done weekly in some people, fortnightly in others, and perhaps only monthly in patients who are more stable. With Joe, I would certainly be regularly assessing these. And in Joe's case, it's difficult to know, depending on what services are available for her, who would be responsible for all these things. Ideally, I'd like to refer Joe to a family-based therapy unit, a specialist service that is available to me because I'm in Sydney. However, I know that many of you are unable to do so, and indeed, my eye has just been caught on a question that says, so how does the GP get the client to eat again? Now, I want to point out that I'm not suggesting for a minute that the GP be looking after the patient on their own. The GP is part of a collaborative care team, and it's really important that there be other people involved in this exercise. But what I'm saying is that you shouldn't leave the GP out of the team either. Somebody needs to be monitoring Joe and every eating disorder's medical state. There are some distinct perils in going it alone. And these are some of the things that I've actually seen in the clients or patients that I've seen. I've seen a patient who's been in psychotherapy, who had continuing unrecognized weight loss, and her first admission, despite 12 months of psychotherapy, was to the intensive care unit where she stayed for a week because she was so unwell. One would hope that that sort of thing wouldn't happen if someone was monitoring the patient's medical state. I've seen a number of misdiagnoses, including one young woman who was referred to me by a dietitian to help in the management of her binge eating disorder, who in fact had severe melancholic depression. I've seen a number of missed diagnoses where comorbid conditions are missed because people looking after the patients are highly specialised and not in a position to recognise either medical decompensation or in some cases coexistent psychiatric disorders, particularly bipolar disorder. One of the issues with not having someone like a GP involved is the patients who slip through the cracks of care. And that so often happens and so often is responsible for patients who have recurrent admissions when they are not cared for in the interim between admissions and are too sick for outpatient therapy by the time they come to care again. And the other issue, without a GP being involved, is that families may decide to withdraw their patients from unsympathetic care. And a GP can provide ongoing support for families so that that situation doesn't arise. Over to you, Michael. I think I've said what I want to say.
That was great. Thank you very much, Jan. That was good. Now, Chris, I'm just going to move our slides on a little bit until we get to your presentation.
Excellent.
Thank you, Chris.
Ooh. There I am. Hi, thank you, everyone. I'm Chris Thornton. I'm a clinical psychologist. And in thinking about how a clinical psychologist would manage Joe, I, like other health professionals, would be, as best as possible guided by the evidence. And the good news about Joe being an adolescent is that we actually have some pretty good data for the sort of things that we need to do with an adolescent with anorexia. And that the therapy that is most often referred to and has the most evidence for it is called Maudsley Family-Based Therapy, or FBT, I'll probably slip into describing it as. And it's certainly got data for patients like Joe that have a early onset, which is, you know, younger than 18 or 19, and a short history, which is less than in 3 years, which is sort of, you know, what Joe is pretty clearly presenting with. FBT is a manualised family approach. Comes from the Maudsley Hospital in London, but the manual was published by James Locke et al. In 2001, and is pretty widely available. So why would I use this? And, you know, as I said, it's about the empirical base. In terms of how many patients gets well, this type of therapy gets around 75 to 80% of these patients well at 12 months follow-up, which for any psychological condition is actually a very good outcome. Clearly, no therapy works for everybody, but 75 to 80% is a good chunk of patients who are doing really well. In the study that's compared it to an individual therapy, FBT had more patients at full remission. At follow-up, it got patients better quicker in terms of weight gain, which is really important given the medical comorbidity, you know, the effects of starvation on the brain and the bones and the menstrual cycle. Rapid weight restoration is really important. And because of the principles of the therapy, which I'll really briefly talk about, it resulted in less relapse, which, you know, and those of us who have worked in eating disorders for a long time really, you know, hear about that revolving kind of door syndrome, and here is a treatment that actually is quite good at preventing relapse. And something that I think is quite important is that there's some studies, what we call dissemination studies, where, you know, something works in the research lab at the university with the authors of it. But there's actually data to say that it, when used in a private practice setting like I'm using it in, there is actually some data to say that the results that we get are pretty much the same as in the research clinics. Most of those, however, are also done in quite specialist eating disordered clinics. You know, the next step in dissemination research is how does it work out in you know, more general private practices. That's not going to advance the slide. So look, and I'm not going to give you a 5-minute version of the 2-day workshop on Maudsley therapy, but some of the principle of it are really worth knowing about, and I think that's just why the therapy works. And the first one there is it takes what's called a very agnostic view of causation. And look, put very simply, it states very clearly parents are not to blame for this illness. It sort of gives an example of, like, we used to think about schizophrenia, where we used to talk a lot about the schizophrenogenic mother, the cold mother who produces schizophrenic symptoms, until we went, oh, actually, it's a biological kind of illness. Very similar stance that FBT takes. In fact, parents are just not to blame. They are actually the number one source of refeeding. Very often in a family with eating disorders, there are other kids who are doing very well, they're very healthy, that are very normal weight. These parents know how to refeed a child or how to feed a child. It's just that when anorexia comes into their family, they get quite paralyzed and stop using the skills that they've used with the other child. And so, and one really important thing with this, and it speaks a lot, and we'll come back to it, about collaborative care, is that the parental self-efficacy in their ability to take control of the child's eating is, in a number of studies, really consistently correlated with outcome. So if the parents feel that they have the right to take responsibility, the need to take responsibility for their child's eating away from the anorexia and with them, that's correlated with outcome. And why that's really important is that interventions in a multidisciplinary team which undermine the parental authority or start to blame the parents actually take away their self-efficacy and, I think, interfere with outcome. And these, you know, it's a family therapy, so they use lots of family therapy techniques like externalization of the illness, which, again, helps the parents take control of the eating away from the anorexia to support and save their child's life. Three phases of treatment. The only phase that people really talk about is the really intense phase one, where the parents are taking charge of the eating. And that's where the bulk of the work is done. And that's very scary for parents to do, because there's high levels of conflict. There can be high levels of expressed emotion in the family. It's also quite scary for therapists to do, because in the therapy room, a lot of these things will play out. One of the criticisms of a FBT approach is, well, who deals with the underlying issues? And they do get dealt with in FBT in phase three, where you're looking at whatever underlying issues are still remaining. And, of course, what we know about anorexia is once you actually refeed somebody and reverse starvation, a lot of what we think are underlying issues actually tend to disappear. So in terms of assessment issues, the assessment issues for MFBT are a little bit different to what you would do in an individual therapy. There would be a diagnostic interview to make sure you've got the diagnosis right. Now, Jo's presenting in a very typical fashion where she's going, I don't have an eating disorder. In a way, you listen to that, you empathise with her view of that, but to some extent you don't take that on board because very clearly she has an eating disorder. Once you've established that the eating disorder is present, you would then go on to the second assessment, which is also a therapy session, which really is actually about where you map the impact of the eating disorder on each family member. And the sort of questions that you would ask there is, what are your worst fears for the patient? And in a way, what you want somebody to say there is to highlight that my worst fear here is that my daughter will die. And we know the mortality rate in eating disorders is significant. And it's something that I always tell parents about, because what I want to do in that assessment is actually to raise the parents' anxiety levels before charging them with, your job now as parents is to stop your daughter dying by taking control of her eating away from the anorexia, and for the time being, until we've reversed that, you taking charge of that. And that's called the grave scene. And then the next session is a family meal, which is also an assessment session, where you ask the family to bring in what they think is enough food to refeed their child, which gives you an assessment of the nutritional understanding of the parents. You know, if they bring in half a sandwich, you know that's not going to be enough. You get them to get their child to eat at least one more bite than the anorexia lets them eat. And that shows you some of the structural issues in the family. If one of the parents is doing all the work or the siblings are getting really involved, it teaches you a little bit about where to go as a therapist. So what you want to do in that, for example, is to bring dad into the picture, to move the siblings into a sibling subsystem. So you get to assess the structural issues, and also at that point you're doing a lot of coaching of the parents to use the skills that they know and that they bring, and that they the sort of the contingency management that they know will work for their daughter into the room. And so it's your one really direct time where you can coach the parents in what to do. And so that's, you know, not a two-day workshop on MFBT, but that hopefully gives you a flavour of how it kind of looks like and some of the core principles, which we'll come back to and talk to, because I think there's some really important issues there for collaborative care. So I think that's back to you, Michael.
Thank you very much. That was a great presentation, Chris. Thank you very much.
Thanks, mate.
Now, Andrew, we'll just get your first slide up here. Thank you very much, all the attendees. We've been all watching all your comments. They're very good and very helpful to us all. Andrew.
Okay, look, thanks. And it's good to come at the end after the other two who said a lot of what I would have liked to say anyway. But look, I think I might just start off by repeating where I come from, because it's relevant to Joe and it's relevant to what we're doing at the Children's Hospital now. And that is saying that when we set up, about 4 years ago, there was a very hodgepodge of therapies available for adolescents with eating disorders. It's disintegrated and non-collaborative approaches. And 3 years ago, I was asked to come and help set up the Royal Children's Hospital Eating Disorder Service. And I'm now clinical co-director there. And for the last 3 years, we've been doing a new assessment of a patient who is thought to have anorexia nervosa every week. So I've seen about 150 around the last 3 years. And we also set up a family-based therapy, a Maudsley family-based therapy treatment program. I come from a background of being a psychiatrist, I mean, after being a paediatrician, and came to the idea that anorexia nervosa needed intensive individual therapy. I've tried and been involved in treatments using cognitive behavioural therapy, cognitive analytic therapy, various forms of family therapy, all of which had different or unclear success rates. And I have to say that it's taken me a while, but I am sold on the idea of family-based therapy being the only therapy which actually we've got a good evidence base for cure. And that's different to an ongoing process of continuing to be unwell, but coming in and out of hospital and some getting better and some not. We're increasingly seeing an enormous decrease in the number of patients who are being admitted to hospital. Now, I wanted with regards to the number of patients I've seen over the last 3 years, having come in the background of seeing many before then, but I'm present for each of those assessments, and I'd just like to make some comments as far as Joe's concerned with regards to the patients I've seen. And Joe is clearly, in many ways, a kind of classic presentation of a young woman with anorexia nervosa, being an obsessive overachiever, and clearly, I think we can all agree, has anorexia nervosa. A number of the patients that have come in, I mean, a very large proportion of the patients I've seen over the last 3 years, I have to say, aren't the classic obsessive overachievers. And I have to say, increasingly, I've become much more, particularly because I've actually been able to see over time what happens to the patients that we see, I've got far less strict criteria for diagnosing anorexia nervosa than I used to have. And by the way, we see a lot of patients who've got comorbid medical problems, increasingly problems such as diabetes and cystic fibrosis and other medical problems where weight is an issue. Generally speaking, though, I have to say, if someone has lost weight, a significant amount of weight, and has not got a medical reason for losing weight, and is unable to put that weight back on for whatever reason, generally speaking, I'd have to say that patient is likely to have anorexia nervosa. I guess we are being referred perhaps the difficult end of the spectrum, but I'd have to say in the patients that are coming through, many of which are referred as not sure if this patient's got anorexia nervosa or not. Generally speaking, my sense is that those kind of very basic ideas about a patient who's lost weight, no medical reason, and can't put it back on again longitudinally, is likely to have anorexia nervosa has held force. Now, increasingly, the younger I'd make a couple of other observations. First of all, yes, we are seeing more boys. Increasingly, just about all the boys we've seen are exercisers, as in a very obsessive focusing on exercise as being the reason for weight loss. A very difficult thing to turn around sometimes, by the way. Though, interestingly, our boys have turned around quite quickly, I think because they particularly don't want to be stigmatised for some reason, but they seem to somehow be turned around quite quickly with FBT. But they're very much exercisers, just as Joe is, which, by the way, also causes some diagnostic problems sometimes in terms of having a low heart rate. And one of the issues has been trying to work out, have they got a low heart rate because of being elite athletes or exercisers or not? And increasingly, we are disregarding the elite athlete status for regards to whether or not we admit patients. And any patient with a heart rate less than 50 is our admission criteria for coming into hospital. Secondly, I'd just like to say that increasingly, younger patients, and certainly we've seen 9, 10, 11-year-olds, as well as older patients, always or almost universally deny cognitions, just as Joe does. It's most of the patients we see, I still say, are you able to tease out a sense of body image distortion, feeling unhappy with some aspect of their body even though they've lost significant amounts of weight. But the younger patients quite often, rather than just talk about cognitions, they talk about that they feel full quickly. That it's not that they want to lose weight, they say, it's just that I feel full for some reason, I can't eat anymore. And DSM-5, with the new diagnostic schedule, has taken out the cognitions, or will be taking out the cognitions in for criteria. In other words, if you have, you can still have cognitions, obviously, but if you don't, if you deny the cognitions but have behaviours which are consistent with a drive for thinness and losing weight, that is enough for diagnosis. Next one. Okay, so basically, just to share with you what we've done at the Royal Children's Hospital, and obviously this isn't available everywhere else, but we decided to actually build a multidisciplinary team from the very beginning, and we do this assessment clinic on an afternoon where is present a psychiatrist, myself, and a paediatrician, and we both do the assessment together. So we're actually in the room together doing the assessment of a young person. There's an FBT therapist who assesses the family, the parents. There's a nurse and a dietitian, all as part of a team which sees patients together. We only admit if they're medically unstable, and it's rare to admit patients these days. But if the patient is medically unstable and they've got a heart rate less than 50, they get admitted. Our model of care has changed absolutely dramatically. I can't get across how dramatically different it is in terms of how we manage these patients from 3 years ago. And it's led to a significant change in the way psychiatry is seen and the way paediatricians are seen. In that, in the past, certainly the Children's Hospital, paediatricians would drive care very often from the point of view of deciding what patients should do and weight gains and so on. Psychiatrists in a mental health facility would be involved in providing therapy one sort or another. In this model, FBT therapist takes over completely with the family, takes over treatment, and psychiatrists, after that initial assessment phase, have very little involvement, if any, if there's no comorbidity, and the paediatrician is only there to check in infrequently to check that they're all right. Interestingly also, I'd have to say that patients, remembering it as a dramatic change, patients with anorexia nervosa are no longer offered any individual therapy whatsoever. And it's been a significant negative from the point of view of other people perceiving how could it possibly be so that you are not offering these young, very disturbed young girls, women, boys, whatever, individual therapy. And my way of seeing it, it's taken me a while to come around to being sold on FBT because of my background. My model of understanding it is that if you have a vulnerability to anorexia nervosa, and the only things that we really have as vulnerabilities are family history, obsessive temperament, plus or minus premorbid obesity, if you have that vulnerability and you lose significant amounts of weight, then you get turned on the anorexia cognitions, which then totally take over every other aspect of your care and of your presentation. And so there is the only way out is the weight gain, and the focus is on weight gain. And FBT, I'm going to say, having watched it over the last 3 years work and see patients get better, my sense is it works partly because of a structural family therapy approach, partly from the externalization that Chris spoke about, partly by actually not avoiding anxiety associated. I think one of the problems we've had in the past is not pushing weight gain, being content with less than ideal weight, recognizing that that's what we need to do. But my sense is with this approach of actually the family takeover, and I think it's a very good question, how do you get the GP, get the patient to eat, and how do the paediatrician, how does the psychiatrist get the patient to eat, and the change in the model of care is how the family can get the person to eat. It's a very intensive treatment for family, I have to say, and part of the deal is how to get that family on board. And partly it's involving raising their levels of anxiety. And it really requires parents taking time off work to start off with quite often. The last point I'd like to make in the slide here is I do think not all families can do it. I have to say increasingly all our families do it. It comes from a perspective of it's a change in psychological way of you actually address the issue yourself, because once we have said this works and you need to do it, families do it, That's single families, it's families who you'd never thought to be able to do it, how to enlist support in doing it, they do it. But my sense is it's very much the difference between going for a cure, not all, it doesn't cure everyone, by the way, but going for a cure versus a chronic illness approach. And by chronic illness approach, I mean someone, basically, how do you kind of keep them going? How do you try and keep them out of hospital as much as possible? How do you focus on function? How do you kind of keep them being okay without and recognizing that they're likely to be unwell for a significant amount of time, probably years, unless you can actually get them cured in the very early phase, which is what FBT is about. I think Chris has spoken about FBT, and I'm not going to go into it in great detail here, except to say that I do think these, as I think I pointed out before, these are, for me, are the things which basically are the main reasons, in my opinion, that FBT works versus other therapies. And one is that there is actual weight restoration, and it's using parents rather than a passive experience, such as being in hospital with a nasogastric tube. It actually involves eating. It involves getting past anxiety, not giving in to the anorexia nervosa, and allowing a patient to get to a healthy weight over a period of time, with the hope that that then leads to a lowering of the cognitions. It is a in some way or another, it's a structural form of family therapy, meaning that you are structuring the family for parents to be parents again and the kid to be a kid again. Obviously, with an older adolescent, this can be problematic. But what we're, as in if you're 17 and just in the process of separating, but we're talking about someone being unwell and needing to, while the process of being unwell, being a child again. Pushing through anxiety, I think, is extremely important. And that means changing, adding new food types, adding weight, all the things that anorexia causes for anxiety, I think, needs to be pushed through and are pushed through with this form of family therapy. The ongoing issue, which I need to ongoingly address with patients that we see, and there's a lot of push from various avenues, including families sometimes with the really hard kids, is that there is, as I say, no individual work during the time of the FBT. And even though Chris mentioned it kind of can be addressed in the later phases of FBT, my sense is that almost all the time, if you get the kid weight restored and they have done well, which is that 70-80%, then actually most problems resolve. However, certainly there's a reasonable proportion of patients we see at the end who we then refer for individual therapy for addressing some of the issues which have been present prior and during the anorexia nervosa evolution. So I think that's all I wanted to say. Yeah.
Thanks very much, Andrew. That was really, really good. Thanks very much. Now we're going to come to the stage of this webinar where the panel will ask each other questions, and I'm more than happy on your behalf, attendees, to ask the panel questions. I'm just going to ask Jan if she could ask Chris a question. I believe you have a question around about the application of family-based therapy outside a specialist unit.
Yeah, I know that FBT is gold standard for adolescents with anorexia nervosa.
Jan, may I just ask you to speak up a little bit, please?
Sorry, can you hear me at all?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, terrific. I agree that Maudsley family-based therapy is the gold standard treatment for adolescent patients with anorexia nervosa. And I think that we have to be clear about the group that it applies to. It's not something that is applied across the board with eating disorders patients. But my concern is that it's only really available in specialist settings at the moment. Are there any aspects of FBT that can be applied successfully outside of the specialist centres?
Yeah, look, I think it's a wide question about dissemination of psychological research, and I think it's actually something that we're quite poor at doing. We develop these wonderful treatments and then they don't really get out there into the general population. I think FBT is quite a complex therapy, and I think that that you know the therapists need to read the manual that's available. I think it's very hard if you've got like one Joe on your caseload to invest so much in professional development, and so in a way. There's a need, I think, to try and develop some expertise as a clinician in dealing with these cases. And of course, you know, I think as we know, once you put out your shingle of going, yeah, look, I do have an interest in eating disorders, you do tend to have a whole practice then of patients with eating disorders, or you start to become your own little specialist centre. And I think at that point, then making sure that you've read the manual is really important. There are two-day trainings that are kind of offered in various states by various kind of specialist centres. But we also know that doing a two-day workshop doesn't really change practice. What's really important after that is, you know, case consultation, ongoing supervision, ongoing professional development around these areas. And so I guess they're my kind of thoughts of, about that. And I mean, that's something that we try and do as a semi-specialist kind of area here at Relief, is do some training, offer case consultation and ongoing kind of case supervision. I think there's a question there also about dissemination of like a cognitive behavioural therapy, which is the gold standard, particularly for bulimia in adults. One of the works that Chris Fairbairn is actually doing now is developing a web-based training program for competencies in CBT. So there's lots of, I think people are starting to pay more attention to these kind of issues. But I think it's a matter of really focusing on us upskilling as clinicians. And I think our responsibility as clinicians is to upskill in the therapy that we know works.
Thanks very much, Chris. That was a really good answer. I believe, Andrew, you had a question to ask Jan about access to specialist services.
I guess that dovetails with your question, Jan, which is partly, I guess, into you personally as a question in how easy it is to access specialist services. But I guess I might make a comment also, following on from what Chris has said about what do you do if FPT isn't available where you are. But yeah, there's a question. I was just interested, as a GP, how easy is it to you to access specialist services, and what do you do if you can't, and how do you kind of manage if you can't?
Look, I work in inner metropolitan Sydney, and it is really difficult for me to access specialist services. Very, very difficult for adults, for adolescents, everybody. The first thing I say to a family to a patient with an eating disorder is, get yourself some private health insurance. Now, that might seem outrageous piece of advice, but care is more readily available in the private sector than it is in the public sector, and even so, it's still very difficult to arrange. I find that I have a group of interested people who are interested and skilled in the management of eating disorders that I can refer to outside of the specialist services, and that's what I have to fall back on.
Can I make an observation too and add to that? Questions, is that all right, Michael?
Yes, please.
Because I was interested, I once did a similar kind of presentation to a group of GPs in rural areas about this, and I guess one of the things that came across to me is they felt they were managing quite well quite a lot of the time. By the way, thank you very much. With kind of stumbling through a lot of the time in not being able to access services, and I guess one of my senses is just to be aware, increasingly I don't have any doubt myself that FBT is the treatment of choice for adolescents currently, and increasingly I think there are increasing numbers of FPT therapists trained who are available privately, and who you can get sessions under the mental health care plans, which quite often they're not difficult for families to afford, and it's helpful to kind of know where they are and what they're doing, but increasingly that those numbers are increasing around the state. And we now increasingly have a kind of number of FBT therapists around who we know on our books and are available. And the other thing, I guess, is just to also be aware, at some level, if you don't have access to FBT, the idea that ongoing good medical care and ongoing good the kind of things that you mentioned in your slides in terms of what you do as a GP, I have to say, is probably not bad. And a number of patients do well despite anything we do, but there are some patients who do really badly, in which case I think we really need to think about how to access specialist services.
And this is the point to the point that you made about the inner city, Jan, and the point that you made about rural, Andrew. It is very interesting in these talks how we find that people living in quite isolated areas in Australia can actually get access to better services, and they have better structures in the towns they're in than many people living in inner cities. So this is not just an issue of lack of resources. I do hear coming through from the attendees a lot of angst, and this has come through in many of our webinars, about the lack of access to psychologists on mental health care plans. Would anybody like to comment on that?
Perhaps I can just say that one of the things that I think is really important in the access to Medicare access to psychologists is a distinction to be made between the conditions that are being referred to psychologists, because eating disorders is one of the conditions that certainly does require a great many more psychological services than many other conditions. And if the federal government could hear the message, it would be great if we could have eating disorders be made a special case. There are certainly not enough sessions available for eating disorders patients from a psychological perspective.
Thanks, Jan. Now,
Michael, can I...
No, please go ahead.
That's certainly an argument that the Australian New Zealand Academy of Eating Disorders has made to the government, and actually suggested that Medicare rebates for eating disorders be specialised by diagnosis and kind of be equivalent to the 52 sessions a year that psychiatrists get. But I guess, when ANZ met with the minister, you know, that one of the cases that we put forward was, you know, we certainly have a good sort of about a 20-session treatment, which FBT is, and please don't cut back on your minimum 18 sessions back to 10, because we have a treatment that can be available to and get 70 to 80% of patients well, that you just actually stopped funding half of it when you cut psychology rebates back to 10 sessions. So that's an argument that we're certainly making.
Good. And that, of course, will increase collaboration between us all if we can get more visits arranged. There was a really good question I saw earlier, and that was to Andrew from Chris, and in relation to introducing medications. Would you like to ask that question, please, Andrew?
Sure. Yeah, it's the use of when to use medication anorexia. First of all, I presume we're all aware that there is no good evidence that medication changes the course of outcome in anorexia nervosa, full stop. Having said that, a lot of medications are used, and we do use medication occasionally. The medications which you used, that we use for the children's, and that are out there that are being used, are either the idea of using SSRIs and the idea of using a anxiolytic of some sort at the time of eating. They're the kind of two medications that come up as possible medications to think about. As far as SSRIs are concerned, the rationale has been in the past the idea that perhaps that some of the obsessive thinking with anorexia nervosa might be helped with SSRIs. There's no evidence that SSRIs helps in that obsessive thinking. But certainly, I think it can be difficult to tell. The time when I would think about using an antidepressant, an SSRI, is more to do with depression, if there's comorbid depression. And it can sometimes be very difficult, I think, to tell if there's comorbid depression because the eating disorder itself is associated with a significant lowering of mood. But certainly if there's a pervasive sense of lowering of mood, and I think that they've got a comorbid depressive illness, I would be thinking of using an SSRI. Certainly I have had a couple of, there certainly can be a crossover with obsessive compulsive disorder, and certainly I have used SSRIs for if there's a clear premorbid OCD with an ongoing OCD, separate to the eating itself and the eating cognitions and obsessions, I'd think about using an SSRI for OCD. The medication that we do sometimes get caught up in, though, is using olanzapine for mealtimes. And that is just with overwhelming anxiety. Olanzapine, there is some... olanzapine, there have been a number of trials looking at olanzapine, and it hasn't really shown that it changes the course of anorexia. It was originally, I guess, introduced partly because it was thought that it had a nice side effect of weight gain, and partly because it was thought that perhaps the cognitions of anorexia were kind of psychotic in nature. It doesn't seem to increase weight effectively. It doesn't make them eat more, and it doesn't seem to make get them better from anorexia better. What there is some evidence, though, is it can decrease the anxiety and help the mood at the time of eating. And a low dose of olanzapine at mealtimes for the really hardcore, out of control, hitting the wall, screaming, anxious kids, sometimes has a significant and helpful role.
Thanks very much. That was a really good answer. Chris, I would just like you to ask this question. Sorry, I jumped in earlier with the question to Andrew, but you did have a question to Jan about some of the problems with parental anxiety when you're commencing FBT and the parents go to the GP for safety. Would you care to ask that question of Jan?
Yeah, look, one of the things that we've discussed is, you know, the way to, you know, empower a parent in a way is to actually raise their anxiety. And we often talk about, you know, this is the most serious mental illness a young child can have. There's high levels of comorbidity, there's high levels of death rates. You know, and often these families are quite emotionally avoidant in a way, and they like to seek reassurance. And I guess one of the things that I think is really important in collaborative care is when they present to a GP, I think they often do that to seek reassurance. And I think sometimes that can act to sort of stall the momentum of FBT and disempower the parents in a way. And I just wanted to know how you deal with that as a GP, or how you think other GPs can be aware of this.
This is really one of the messages that you desperately need to get out to GPs, that the anxiety that you induce in the parents about the illness is part of the therapy. And I don't think very many people are aware of that. And it also is the reason why a lot of people throw up their hands in the air and say, we don't want to have anything to do with family-based therapy. It's not humane, you know. So that is one big message that needs to go out both to general practitioners and to psychologists in the community, because on the surface of it, it doesn't seem right. And I must say that I haven't met too many families where their anxiety levels weren't already quite high around the eating disorder.
Do you see any role for the mental health practice nurse in this as a go-between?
Who's that question for?
It's for you all.
I think the mental health practice nurse probably does have a big role in this. It may be appropriate for a patient who is medically stable to be regularly seeing the mental health practice nurse for information, education. But what is really important is that all the members of the team, whoever they are, be communicating with each other.
Mm.
And,
mm.
you know, that stuff about the parents need to be anxious in order for FBT to be useful needs to be communicated to the family's general practitioner, who will communicate it to the mental health practice nurse. It just won't work if the FBT practitioners are working in isolation.
Yeah.
Can I add too? Because I actually, one of the things I think is the dramatic change is actually handing over treatment to the FBT therapist, a lot of the treatment. And my sense is that FBT will actually only work really if you've got a good FBT therapist who can get the parents on board, who can actually, not just by kind of, I mean, raising anxiety is important to get them to be able to be motivated, but it's also important to actually engage them in getting it right, I guess, and having trust in the therapist initially, and then the therapist giving the parents trust, faith, and allowing them to feel that they actually can do it, and they don't need to get anxious and worried about it because they can do it. And my experience has been that it is a little bit FBT therapist dependent in them being able to get the right amount of anxiety and then to be able to contain it themselves without feeling that they that it has to overflow into other places.
I've just seen a question there from Renee Slim, which expands on this again. What role do you see in school psychologists and school counselors and schools, for example, in this management? Do they need to be brought into the circle?
Yeah, very much. I do a lot of work talking at schools to teachers. And I think the answer that's sort of scrolling up there at the moment is early identification. And I think school psychologists and school teachers have a great role in you know, targeting the kids who are at risk for eating disorders, and sort of tracking their eating as part of part of the role of a school counsellor. I think sometimes where schools can make a mistake, particularly when FPT is being involved, is parents will often go to the school, well, can you supervise my child's eating at lunch? And the answer to that is generally no, they can't, because no one can supervise a child's eating like a parent. And so one of the tough things about FBT in these early stages is parents need to take time off work and go to school and supervise their child's eating, because nobody can do it. There's supervising a kid with anorexia is not just sitting there to see whether the food is eaten, because as soon as you're looking away, that food is in the drawer, it's in the bin, it's in the pot plant. You know, and the school psychologist, you know, can't possibly supervise things as well as the a parent. So I think the school are involved in treatment and then liaising with a GP and the service providers and providing referrals. But I think in terms of and providing things like academic support and liaising with the treatment team in terms of, you know, the mental state of the patient, what they're able to do at school. So they have a very important role in that liaison and identification. I think some problems can start to occur where they get too involved in the treatment, particularly with an FBT model.
Yep. And there was another good question came up there from Lynette Olivier, a role for peer group education and support, boyfriends, girlfriends. You know, I mean, these kids are kids and they're adolescents. They're going through all the other normal adolescent stresses and events. How do you see their role in this model?
Do you want me to answer quickly? It's a very close-knit group, I think, the treatment of with FBT, and it does what it does use is other members of the family, and anyone else that's having a good. Quite often, we found that we need to use in doing the FBT under some circumstances, someone who is either a parental role or someone as a peer support for the person, well, support for them. The siblings are seen as support for the young person going through what they're going through, where the parents are seen as taking a parental role, involving peer group. In as part of the treatment, I don't know about your experience, Chris, but we haven't been involved. It's kind of a recognition that you need to get the person well and out there with their peers as quickly as possible. So rather than involve them in the treatment, it's seen that they are certainly not to keep them away from their peers, but not to involve them in the treatment process itself, or boyfriends or whatever in the treatment process, and to want to keep those relationships going and re-engage them as part of the treatment.
Thanks. That's good. Do any of you have any further last questions? We're unfortunately coming close to the end. Any pressing questions? Jan, do you have any questions that you haven't had answered?
Look, I noticed somebody asking about what to do about young adults who'd already left home and didn't have a family to help in their treatment. And I have to say that we have to bear in mind that FBT is therapy for adolescents. There is another model from the Maudsley that is being developed to help young adults, but there are an awful lot of people who don't meet the criteria for family-based therapy in the form that Chris and Andrew are talking about it now. Isn't that right, you guys?
Absolutely.
because we are talking about adolescence. And, you know, because we're running out of time, it's quite clear that there are a whole lot of other questions that need to be asked about other groups of people with eating disorders, and both need to be asked and need to be answered. And I think maybe we need to do that at another time. But in this instance, we're talking about adolescents with anorexia nervosa, not even adolescents with bulimia nervosa, but adolescents with anorexia nervosa.
Yes, and MHBN certainly intend to extend this discussion into those groups that you're talking about. Lastly, just the role of social workers, dietitians, all the allied health spectrum who assist us so much in our networks throughout the country. Just briefly, could Chris or Andrew comment on that?
Because I think Andrew's saying it very well in terms of when he goes, the FBT therapist. And what we're not saying is, and that has to be a clinical psychologist or a psychiatrist or a social worker. It's someone trained in FBT. So I think there are a lot of ways that, in fact, there are some very good dietitians who are trained in FBT. There's excellent social workers who are trained in FBT. So I think it's one point. It's not a discipline. And the manual states this very clearly. It's not a one-discipline gig. It's, you know, anybody can kind of get trained and do this. And I think that's really important. I think it's just sort of going back to the point with whoever is in the treatment team needs to be schooled in the model of therapy. If the treatment team makes a decision that the model of therapy is FBT, which, you know, fairly clearly I think it should be because that's our evidence-based model, it's actually, I think, also, and this has helped me kind of think through things a little bit actually, it's very much the responsibility of that FBT clinician to school everyone who's involved in the treatment team into the model and what they're doing and what the core kind of principles are. And I can see how that is such a good investment to talk about the diet. And dietitians aren't often involved when families are involved in FBT, and it's a very controversial point in our field. But if they are involved, learning about the core principles of the model and the importance of parental self-efficacy for taking control is really important. So I think it's actually up to the FBT practitioner to liaise with the GP, liaise with everybody who's involved with the treatment team.
On the other hand, dietitians are very often involved in other groups of patients with eating disorders.
Absolutely.
Very effectively involved.
Yeah.
Just one point that I want to make about collaboration. This issue of communication amongst team members is really important here, not least of which because of the patient's tendency to triangulate their therapists. One of the things that I always do if I'm in charge of weighing a patient or just seeing a patient regularly for medical monitoring, I SMS everybody in the team, the patient's weight and any relevant information about their current health status, if, for example, they've got an ear infection or the flu. Those sorts of pieces of information need to be disseminated amongst each member of the team in order that everybody's on the same page with it.
Yes, I would certainly agree with that, Jan. I mean, communication is the essence of collaboration, isn't it? Unfortunately, we're coming very close to the end now, so we're going to just go in reverse order from where we started. And, Andrew, I'm going to ask you just to sum up for 2 minutes, please.
So to sum up, thank you for warning me that I was going to sum up.
I find people always sum up better if they don't have any warning.
Thank you very much. I guess it's hard. It's been hard to kind of sit and watch the comments that are coming down the bottom. I haven't been able to read them all, and I've seen some of them coming back and forth. And my guess is that, however, some of the things that I've seen include some further questions about FBT. They include things about how to kind of access FBT, what to do if you don't have FBT there, and also what to do with the older population. All very reasonable questions. I guess my sense is just if we can, the message I'd like to give here is that if we're talking about adolescent anorexia nervosa as we are this evening, my sense is that there has been a dramatic change in the way we manage it, with a view to have a family-based, outpatient, manualised treatment for anorexia nervosa, which there's a good evidence base for, but more importantly, from my point of view, having been involved with it for the last 3 years, it does work if you've got access to that. It doesn't work all the time, by the way. Certainly, without going, spending a lot of time talking about when it doesn't work all the time. We need to have fallback positions, and I do think myself that one of the most important things actually is a good GP who's got an interest and then is able to monitor and develop that therapeutic relationship with someone over a period of time is a very important, and if not the one of the most important aspects of an ongoing care of someone with anorexia nervosa. But that is, again, for the group that you don't have access, in my opinion, anyway, to FBT. It's a radical change in the way we see it. It's a radical change in the way of needing to get our heads around, and I think it does require a seismic shift in the way you see things in terms of it not being involved in doing individual therapy, and also going, and my screen's just gone off. Sorry, I'll just have to...
You're still on ours.
Yes, I know, but I can't see you. So
we can still hear you, Andrew.
Seismic shift in the way you kind of engage patients and deal with patients, but and the way you kind of are able to externalise the illness and sort of imagine that you don't have to do, from my point of view, psychological therapies for the individuals. I presume it is going to stir up a lot of questions in people who don't see how it works. Clearly, there's a lot of problems still with access to services and in managing patients who aren't first presentation adolescents.
Thank you very much. That's really, really good, and that's what these webinars are all about. Chris, you've got 2 minutes.
Oh, I could sum up Andrew's summary. I think the key message is as for a long time in anorexia, we haven't had any science to really guide us and any data to really guide us. And when we've got some data that suggests we have a successful treatment, I think it's up to us to, upskill ourselves and get our heads around that treatment. It is mainly available in specialist services, I guess it's for people on the webinar. Look out, research what those specialist services are, Google the three of us and I'm sure we're very happy to provide as much information as you need about it. I just want to say what I love about the data from FBT is a lot of parents and therapists feel completely hopeless when faced with anorexia nervosa, and there very much is hope in treating these early onset cases, and I think that's a really important message to get across. There is also hope for the older adults as well, and I'd love to come back and do another webinar with these guys on what to do with older patients, because there is some data to kind of guide us, and we've got some cool ideas about that as well. But, the whole seminar's really got me thinking about how, if FBT is going to be that central model of choice, it's the FBT practitioner's responsibility to bring every bit of our body on the team on board. As we're trying to get the parents on board and at the same level of structure, and, we always say in FBT, be on the same page all the time, that's the same message really that's got to be out there for clinicians. So thank you for the opportunity to have a chat. It's been cool.
No, that's great, Chris. Jan, you've got 2 minutes.
Okay. There's been talk in the text box about dialectical behaviour therapy and narrative therapy, and in that context, I just want to say that there is evidence to support the use of all sorts of different therapies in eating disorders, but what we've been talking about here is adolescents with anorexia nervosa, and the evidence is undoubtedly very clear that this is the very best model of therapy for that group of patients. And I just want to stress that there are other therapies that are useful in patients, in different groups of patients with anorexia nervosa, CBT, as Chris said, for patients, adult patients with bulimia nervosa. Narrative therapy is a fabulous therapy for eating disorders. DBT is really useful for patients who've got comorbid personality disorders, as many of the bulimia patients do. So it's worth bearing in mind that there's an awful lot more that we need to say about eating disorders, but what we have been talking about is adolescents with anorexia nervosa. The other point that I want to make is, and I'm sure you've heard this in what I've said already, please don't leave the patient's GP out of the loop as far as eating disorders treatment is concerned. When you're finished with them, the patients are going to go back to the GP, and the GP needs to know what's been going on in the 6 or 12 months that they've been out of their orbit. So it's really important to keep the GPs in the loop right through the process. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you very much, and I would like to thank the three of you so much. I know how much hard work you've all put into this behind the scenes in the weeks before this webinar, in constructing the slides that wouldn't be overlap, and how we could concentrate on this one particular case in adolescents with anorexia nervosa. I'm just blown away by the amount of information I've received tonight, and I can see that the attendees are very impressed, and on their behalf I'd like to thank you all. Some of the key points I took away from you, Jan, was the medical workup, remembering that the patient is a person, that they are not just their eating disorder, the issues about suicidality and the ongoing medical checks and cares to ensure that this illness, which does have a significant mortality rate, does not end up in mortality. Chris presented to us very cogently the monthly family-based therapy. Its 75 to 80% remission rate is just fantastic, emphasizing the achieving parental self-efficacy by inducing a parental anxiety and involving the parents in the management and also addressing the underlying issues. Andrew gave us a great insight into the basic ideas in diagnosis, and I like simple ways of diagnosis because I'm a GP. So basically, if somebody has got a low weight and is able to put on weight, you probably have your diagnosis without having to ream through DSM-4. He emphasized that there are more males presenting now, and that they only needed to be, that patients only need to be admitted if they're medically unstable, and that offering individual treatment is probably not the way to go. One needs to adopt this family therapy, and that medications are indicated if there are comorbid issues or conditions, but not necessarily just because the patient has been diagnosed with anorexia nervosa. On behalf of all the attendees, I would just like to thank our panel very much. And on behalf of our panel and MHPN, I'd like to thank all of our attendees, particularly those in Western Australia who suffered some dreadful weather recently, and I hope you and your families are all well over there. And also the Queenslanders and New South Wales people who've missed the state of origin tonight to attend this. And I think that is an indication of practitioners' interest in this topic. I wish you all well. I do not know who is winning the state of origin at the moment. I do hope it is Queensland.
Don't tell me. I'm typing it.
Good night, everybody, and thank you all for attending.